on the additional knowledge systems bill, a bill that we believe is very important here, a bill that we believe is important in ensuring that indigenous knowledge is acknowledged and documented, patented, that copyright, intellectual property taken care of, but believing that it's one bill that cuts across and different departments, and we hope that we will be able to achieve what we expect or is expected of us as a portfolio committee of science and technology. the bill cuts across different disciplines, and we are conducting these public hearings here in Parliament. The bill will also eventually go to the National Council of Provinces that deals with the provinces, and definitely when the process goes to the NCOP, they will take it to provinces, so there will be other public hearings at provincial level. We are, as I said, that we are very interested and very excited. We have so far had some preliminary meetings and formal presentations. We met with the Department of Health. They made a presentation with the Department of Agriculture and the Department of Environment, Agriculture, COCTA. We've had some academia coming to present, giving their views on the bill itself. And then that doesn't mean that the process is finalized, so the process will still continue for those who still want to make a submission. We have public hearings this week and next week, and then the committee will also get input from our legal advisor. Before we go further, as a form of welcome also, I'll also ask Dr. Filippi to take us from the historic background of the bill so that we put things into perspective. Vet, I want to say Happy New Year, hoping that this year will be, all of us will be our best year. And whatever individually, personally, and committees and everybody, whatever we dream of and we want to achieve, will be given to us, will be granted to us. Welcome once again, and hoping that you are excited about ourselves, and hoping that this public hearing will benefit the public, and your input will take us a step further. With that, I would like to start with the introduction of us. My name is Lindy Masebo. I'm the acting chairperson of the Portfolio Committee on Science and Technology. Let me start from here.
Good morning, I'm Amelie Lockwood, also a member of the committee.
Good morning, I'm Chantal King, a member of the committee.
Good morning, my name is Amelie Paulson and I'm a member of the committee.
Good morning, my name is Edna Stack and I'm from the committee.
Good morning, my name is Nico Alok, I'm also a member.
Kassel Matale, committee member.
Anthony Rees, Chairman of the Traditional and Natural Health Alliance.
Let's go to the next so that you know who's here, please. You pressed the wrong
Thank you, Chair. Sureshni Govinda, Parliamentary Communication Services.
Stephen Edwin, the coordinator of the Indigenous and Resistance Organization Center here in the Centre.
Portia Manzini, member of PMG. Jordan Michelle, also member of PMG.
Laura Johnson, also a member of PMG.
Winga Pata, also from PMG.
Sudhir Pamishka from the University of Stellenbosch.
Khunza Mutholi, Department of Science and Technology, Leo Services.
Good morning, I'm Shirley Mursami, also DST Leo Services.
Good morning, my name is Carol von Beck from the Department of Science and Technology, Indigenous Knowledge Management.
Good morning, my name is Jonas Teresi. I am Chief Director for Science Missions.
Morning, honorable members. My name is Shumi Pango from the Department of Science and Technology, Indigenous Knowledge Systems Office, Policy Development.
Good morning, my name is Carol Marte. I'm here on behalf of Bongiwe Mfuno for the Principal Secretary of the Chief State of Kaifa.
Good morning, Chair, this is Michael Mendes. I'm Barbara Lewis, I'm Parliamentary Leader Founder.
Good morning, thank you, Chair. My name is Roy Johnson. I'm from Sefaka Makato Health Sciences University. And I'm also a council member of the Allied Health Professions Council, but I'm here in my personal capacity.
Thank you very much for the introduction. Thank you. Oh, sorry.
I'm Benny Rick van Wyk. I'm a research professor at the University of Johannesburg.
Thank you very much. All of you will be most welcome once again. And so without much waste of time, I'd like to say first to the committee that Shanaz will give us a amended program. The second item will be giving an opportunity to Dr. Yona Fuleti, who's the Chief Director of Science Missions in the DST, of the historic context of the bill, as I said earlier on. Then we have Professor Roy Robson of Makati Health University. Then we have Professor Dean Van Day. And then we have Professor Kajita. And then the last one we have Mr. Tukukuzwa, controller. And then we have also have questions and discussion and way forward. Some people who are supposed to come have withdrawn, but we will see if they come again. Dr. Fuleti, can I give the opportunity to you to take us through the historic context?
Thank you, Chair, and honorable members of the committee and esteemed stakeholders. It is indeed a historic occasion that we should be coming towards the final round of process of consultation. The historical genesis of the IKS policy goes back to the late 90s, actually started here in Parliament within the Arts, Culture, Science and Technology Portfolio Committee. At the head of it was Professor Serote, and this process went through national consultation and culminated into the IKS policy of 2004. Meanwhile, there had also been, before 2004, an attempt for an individual private member's bill on the protection of IKS, which had not advanced a lot. The papers probably of the bill is broad. It has four driving concepts: the promotion, the protection,
the development and the management. So there has to be a balance between those four elements of the bill. So it covers those elements. But to a larger extent, the historical conjecture at which this arises is that of redress and transformation within the nation. Redress in as far as the issues of national identity and social cohesion, that indigenous knowledge would be a very powerful and useful tool in the process of national identity and social cohesion. There was also the issue of mainstreaming of indigenous knowledge, that it had been marginalized, that as a nation we were building a wealth of knowledge without including national resources, which included indigenous knowledge system. So it was to address the issue of marginalization of indigenous knowledge as a knowledge in our knowledge system. The aspect, one aspect which has been referred to by the chair is that of acknowledgement, recognition of indigenous knowledge in the face of globalization. And this process is a global process, it's not just the African process, and bodies such as UNESCO, the World Intellectual Property Organization, the Convention for Biological Resources, the Nagoya Protocol, all are focused on how these resources can be recognized. There's also the issue of research, development, and innovation. And this has been a critical role in which the Department of Science and Technology has played a role in creating systems such as centers of excellence, such as research chairs, and the academic program such as the Bachelor of Indigenous Knowledge Systems. The science councils, most of the science councils have mainstreamed indigenous knowledge as an area of research in a different scope of work, whether it is the Agricultural Research Council or the Medical Research Council, they've also done that. Indigenous knowledge system has been a concern of government and many government departments. It started with arts and culture, science and technology, but it has permeated departments of environmental affairs, agriculture, rural development, and therefore this bill provides a mechanism of alignment of government policy, it provides a mechanism of streamlining legislation, provides a mechanism for coordination, but also for the public, provides a mechanism, a regulatory framework for the access to indigenous knowledge systems. There have been many reasons where people have tended to focus more on protection. And I think we have an overwhelming concentration on that aspect rather than looking at the importance of the other three. The legislation is not just about protection as much as it is important. Now, the reasons for the protection, we could maybe give a few reasons. We can begin with the issue of the balance of rights now, between the knowledge holders and the knowledge users. There has to be a balance of rights. So to this extent, we have had to, it's an innovation. It is going on in the World Intellectual Property Organization, that the knowledge holders and the knowledge should be the focus. So the right of protection to grant access has been vested in the knowledge holders and the communities. It is important to look at the legal certainty, and that we've looked at that as well. And in that context, how do we prevent misappropriation and biopiracy? And how do we give appropriate permission and facilitate the appropriate use of indigenous knowledge? It's not just a one-sided kind of activity, it has to be a balance between the different interests. We've also looked at the economic rights and the moral rights. Moral rights extensive, cultural, but they also look at issues of legacy and how we take this into the future. Then we've looked at the rights for promotion and development. Researchers have a right to access and research without being inhibited. So this particular legislation attempts to provide a framework which is certain, where areas which are not clear should be eliminated. It also creates a building of confidence between communities so that it is not done arbitrarily by the knowledge holder or by the person that are interested in exploitation. So the large thrust of this is this balance, and there has to be balance between the different interest groups. There has to be balance between public interest and individual interest. And these are also constitutional rights. And so the IKS bill gives effect to the implementation of constitutional rights to this. It is also about human rights and as contained in the Bill of Rights. So this bill, in every way, is a facilitating bill to ensure that the community and the society is in power. It does not pit itself against the people that exploit IKS, but create opportunities for further exploitation and use and creation of industries in IKS. So it has to be made clear that in every way the context is that of redress and transformation. How do we use indigenous knowledge systems for those two purposes of redress and transformation of the society? That's the context. I've avoided to go into the details of each one of them. I've provided the larger framework of the policy drive while this has been pushed across. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Dr. Selassie. Just before we go forward, is there any question to Dr. Selassie in relation to the context that he has presented? Not, let's then hear Professor Johnson from Sokoko Makati
House. Thank you, Chair. Unfortunately, we are unable to connect the system so you could see my slides. I would actually like to start, though, with noting and acknowledging the passing of Dr. Humphreys Akufa on Sunday afternoon, who was a previous registrar of the Medicines Control Council, and I was a member at the time he was there. So just to acknowledge that Dr. Zakruva has passed.
Thank you very much for that acknowledgement, and may soul rest in peace.
Thank you, Chair. So the first thing I wanted to say is that there's a correction that I need to make for the committee in terms of my written submission of the 15th of December. I left out a word in my point one where I intended to say that the bill does not explicitly exclude traditional health practitioners using indigenous knowledge in their healing practices. And so my presentation and framework comes from my background as a medical doctor and as a specialist clinical pharmacologist. So if you can just please keep that in mind. In terms of the protection, as has already been alluded to, a few examples come to mind of where there was no protection. Hudia Gordoni-I was a supposed weight loss assistance, but the evidence was not there. It was based on a possible misinterpretation of what some SAM people were said about the plant. There's Pelagonium sidoides, which got co-opted, if I can be, use a kind word, by a German missionary, I think it was, to treat tuberculosis in Germany. Skeletal tortuosum has been used, the active ingredient has been used in a commercial product, which is an unregistered medicine. Artemisia afra is an interesting one because a particular person was marketing a product which contained Artemisia afra, but claimed that it was artemisinin and effective against malaria, and there was not yet any evidence for that. The plant that is effective against malaria is Artemisia annua, and that is found or grown in China. And then I think I put in almost irreverently cannabis sativa, although I know there's a lot of work being done on how that particular plant is going to be possibly used medicinally. It is not dead yet there, and would that be considered a traditional or indigenous knowledge plant? And then, unfortunately, I can't show you this, but I had a slide of a complementary medicine submission to the Medicines Control Council from 2009, and this was during the period of the avalanche of so-called complementary medicines being submitted to the MCC. And this one was called Ngoma Umuti Wenyongo. So I'm told that it was used for diarrhea in babies. So there's a problem there. So this was put forward as a complementary medicine when in fact it's probably a traditional medicine. There's another issue that's all about patents, and the lawyers are here. I'm informed repeatedly that no natural substances can be patented, but new combinations can be. And so we need to, this bill, I think, needs to, in or further down, maybe when it's an act of their regulations, it may need to address that. How do new combinations get regulated or controlled? One example I can tell you of is called Omega Caro E. This is a patented supplement which is just says that you can actually patent certain substances. Because of the broadness, as already alluded to, I looked at the traditional Health Practitioners Act, and I listed in my presentation a variety of definitions. But one of the things that's explicit in the traditional Health Practitioners Act is that traditional health practice excludes the professional activities of a person practicing any of the professions contemplated in the Pharmacy Act, the Health Professions Act, the Nursing Act, the Allied Health Professions Act, or the Dental Technicians Act, and any other activity not based on traditional philosophy. So I don't think the Indigenous Knowledge Systems Bill adequately addresses who is not or who should be excluded from being an Indigenous interestingly also, traditional health practitioners act under the definition of traditional philosophy refers to indigenous African techniques, principles, theories, ideologies, beliefs, opinions and customs, and uses of traditional medicine, communicated from ancestors to descendants, or from generation to generation, etc. And that was in chapter 4, clause 9.1 of the bill, which is called Protection of Indigenous Knowledge. And the subject matter of the protection, protect Indigenous knowledge, cultural, functional, and nature, or both, including medical. And I am not sure that that is the right term for what is intended, because medical, by its definition, is already Western in many ways. So I would like to just re-emphasize that point. Then the eligibility criteria for protection, in my presentation, indicated the similarity between clause 11A and the definition of traditional philosophy in the Traditional Health Practitioners Act. Then we have regulations for the Traditional Health Practitioners Act, and as far as I know, these regulations have not yet been finalized, but they spell out categories of traditional health practice, where people need to undergo educational training. And I do think that it would be helpful in the bill, or when it's passed in the regulations, to spell out what categories of indigenous knowledge systems practice are envisaged. In the Traditional Health Practitioners Act draft regulations, it refers to divination, herbalism, traditional birth attendants, and a traditional surgeon. Another issue that I'm highlighting is that in the bill, there's in 29 subsection 1, there's a part called transnational arrangements, which refers to indigenous knowledge originating in a foreign jurisdiction. And I want to draw your attention that some of those are already catered for in the Allied Health Professions Act. And the three that stand out are Ayurveda, Chinese medicine and acupuncture, and United medicine. I then present the definition of a medicine in terms of the Medicines Act, and compare that to, and then include the definition of a complementary medicine according to the regulations of the 15th of November 2013. I know that there are draft regulations which change that definition, but they have not yet been finalized. And I think it's important to note that there's no definition of African traditional medicines in these regulations, but that the MCC has an African Traditional Medicines Committee. Another issue that I think is going to become an issue is, in terms of the Medicines Act, if you wish to dispense a medicine or make a medicine available to the public, you need a dispensing license. This obviously would refer to medicines that have been registered, and that includes the Pharmacy Act and the Allied Health Practitioners Act. So my question then is, what would the legal constraint be on accredited Indigenous knowledge practitioners in terms of formulating, compounding, and dispensing of remedies or medicine? I then address what I have called quasi-traditional practitioners or practices, one of which is possibly a discipline which has arisen from other roots called ethnomedicine and includes ethnopsychology. There are questions around integrative medicine, and then I just need to note that the Traditional Healers Organization is registering practitioners. For example, there's Dr. Boxall, who is a registered traditional healer and sells Dr. Boxall's remedies. I think all of those need to be considered. In the Medicines Act, Clause 3, or Section 3, it states, in determining whether or not the registration or availability of a medicine is in the public interest, regard shall be had only to the safety, quality, and therapeutic efficacy thereof in relation to its effect on the health of humans or any animal, as the case may be. So again, my question is, how will the safety, quality, and therapeutic efficacy of African traditional medicines be determined in the public interest? And parallel, how will the safety, quality, and therapeutic efficacy of Indigenous knowledge systems, medicines, or remedies be determined in the public interest? I then have a question about accreditation. Could a conventional, and in inverted commas, Western medical practitioner, such as myself, also be accredited as an Indigenous knowledge practitioner if I produce the correct information and certification for being accredited? And then, could an Indigenous knowledge practitioner obtain a practice number, in inverted commas, from the Board of Health Funders, which has implications for patients claiming from medical aid, and this would have to go through the Council for Medical Schemes. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Prof. That's the presentation. I don't know if members would like to ask some questions of clarity from Prof. Yeah, and shall I do that at the corporate flight, so do you. stipulated to members. Do you have any questions? Honourable Coroner.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Thank you for the presentation. Mr. Jobson, I just want to know what is your expert knowledge in the field of African traditional medicine, first? And how does the Medicines Act identify African
traditional
medicine? Does the Medicines Act define African traditional medicine? So, thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honourable Member. At this stage, the Medicines Act does not define African traditional medicines, although there is a committee of the Medicines Control Council to deal with it. So my knowledge of African traditional medicines stems mainly from interaction with that committee and the chairperson of that committee, and also I have at some stage or other submitted a complaint to the Advertising Standards Authority about a product that was on the market already claiming to be an African traditional medicine.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just in terms of your proposal, the written proposal, on paragraph 3, you say that I have not specified these areas of concern, but should the portfolio wish me to do so, I would gladly oblige. Can we ask you to keep that in writing to us, please?
Certainly, I would be very happy to do that.
Thank you very much, Prof. For bringing to the attention of the committee on the issues that you raised. And I think one thing that we said to ourselves as we're looking at the bill before the public hearing is that we would want to see a one-stop shop so that an ordinary person is not sent from pillar to post in obtaining probably one certificate. And that there should be some collaboration with the other departments so that if there is a need to amend some aspects of some of the acts that relate to the indigenous knowledge system, that we should work together. So that the departments or as public representatives, we don't work in silos. But if one department or one ministry can compromise on a paragraph that they probably accommodated in this bill, if they didn't fit that this bill will better represent the views also of that particular act. So let's do that, so that we try and bring together the fragmented aspects that deals with indigenous knowledge, but also take into account and bring into the attention of the department also where there is an omission. So we greatly welcome your submission. I'm not sure the legal advisor, is there anything you want to say or?
Thank you, Jason. I'll make notes as we're going along, but at this stage my function will be at the end when the department has commented from a policy perspective just to advise the committee on constitution and capital. At the moment there's nothing that I've flagged that will prevent what Jason is saying.
Thank you very much. And once again, thank you, Prof. Honourable Person.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, may I put forward a follow-up question? Dr. Johnson, you mentioned that you interacted with a committee at some stage. Does that committee still exist?
Thank you, sir. I resigned from the Medicines Control Council some years ago, so I haven't been in contact with that committee and I do not know its lists. I haven't been informed that it no longer exists, and so my assumption would be that it still does exist.
Thank you very much, Prof. We also apologize that we couldn't slide your slides, but our colleague secretary has got them and will make them available to members of the committee. If there's a need, we will come back to you. And as I said, if you can fit, that when the process is also in provinces, you would want to attend some of those public hearings and make your submission again there, and you're most welcome. So thank you very much. The next presenter will then be Professor Van Dijk. Starting botany and plant biology with UJ.
Thank you, Mrs. Chairman. Thank you for the opportunity. I would like to say that as a botanist, I have a deep respect.
Can I just find out, do you have slides that need to
be like? Yes, I do have beautiful slides, but I guess I will have to make do without them.
We would probably need to come.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, as I said, I'm a botanist with many years of experience in working exactly with indigenous knowledge systems. Because Southern Africa and South Africa is a very special place. The botanical diversity in this country is tremendous. Also the fact that more than 60% of our plants in South Africa are endemic. They're only found here and nowhere else. So this is a tremendous geographical advantage for the future. In the same way, we also have a tremendous cultural diversity, a very unique cultural diversity. And if you superimpose these two unique geographical assets, you come up with something really special. So I've spent 30 years of my career to promote the development of botanical science to make it relevant, and as such it is close to the concept of transformation. Because I probably more than many other people
understand how profound the knowledge is that is situated within local communities. And thus, there's nothing more special for me than to meet the professor of the veld. I'm the professor of the books. They are the professors of the veld, often illiterate people, with profound knowledge about plants and the uses of plants. If you go on YouTube, you will see a short film that was made with the title The Professor. They took up this idea and they made a little video to show the interaction between the professor of the books and the professor of the film. Anyway, so this exceptional biological and cultural diversity of South Africa are unique assets of international importance. And I really appreciate the explanation given by the professor when he said that there should be a balance between protection, management, development, and so forth. I would like to say, as a scientist, basic scientific research is an urgent priority in order to maximize the scientific, cultural, and socio-economic opportunities presented by this rich diversity. So, the aim of research is not to collect secrets from anyone. And I suppose there are some scientists who go for such practices, but in general, research is aimed at publishing new data and new insights. It is an international activity. It is not for commercial motives, very often not for commercial motives, but for cultural enrichment. And in the context of Africa, I think it's even more important to realize the role that plant knowledge can play in bringing about a transformation and a deeper understanding of how profound indigenous knowledge really is. The more you understand botanical science, the more you understand the depth of the ancient knowledge. So we published papers, I have here on my slide, a recent paper of the medicinal plants of the Kamiesberg, done by a brilliant master student. The participants in this study, the five wise persons who participated, are all deceased now, 3 years later. If it was not for the study, the knowledge, recorded knowledge of the Kamiesberg would be only a fraction of what we have today. Because there are no young people in the Kamiesberg with the depth of knowledge that these old people had. We carefully and systematically recorded information using modern standards of ethics, international best practices, and we give full recognition in this scientific paper. I'll give it as an example. In the scientific paper, every anecdote is carefully recorded against the name of the person who provided the information. So I think from a legal point of view, and when it comes to ownership of intellectual property, there can be no doubt whose knowledge is presented in this paper. The publication also gives a starting date for that manifestation of ownership. The thesis itself, I may add, was lodged in the libraries in the Namakoland, so that local people are able to go to the library and read all the information that was recorded, including the photographs of these people with permission. It was put in the thesis. And this means that the grandchildren of these wise people can one day have a complete record of the knowledge that was provided by their grandfathers and grandmothers. So that is one way in which we publish indigenous knowledge, is through scientific publication. The other is through books. And books have a value in presenting and educating and informing
And I think one of the reasons why South Africa is a popular tourism attraction is because of the quality of the guidebooks that we have in South Africa. It is one of the countries in the world where the quality of books about nature, plants and animals, is of a very high standard. And I think in the future, tourism will become more and more sophisticated, and as such there will be a need for high quality publications that deals with plants and animals, and inevitably that will also touch on aspects of indigenous knowledge. So I have here a slide showing the books. I've in my career written 19 books with translations and second edition. This comes to about 43 editions. I've also published many international books where I'm trying to correct the historical imbalance of not having African plants in books that claim to have a world coverage. So for example, Medicinal Plants of the World covers my book. It's translated in several languages. It covers all the commercially important medicinal plants of the world, but there's a slight bias towards including a few more of the commercialized African plants that would probably be justified. So I'm trying actively to promote the African component because it is lacking at the moment. And there are many practical reasons why African plants should be included in these publications, because it creates a paper record for future use in, for example, applications for registration, etc. If a plant is totally unknown in the literature, it is very unlikely that it will be accepted in Western markets one day. So this is something for the future. So to become specifically, more specific to the bill, I think written publication about traditional knowledge, as I demonstrated, is very different from the kind of unauthorized uses I understand the bill seeks to constrain. I'm familiar with cases where plant extracts were sought to be patented, both with or without community support. In the case of Scalithium with community support, and also Pelagoni, and I was directly involved in a number of research papers on these plants. In fact, I was deeply involved in the initial stages of the development of some of these concepts. But the publication about the uses of plants, whether in scientific journals or books, is a very different matter, and should be entirely exempted from the law. The Intellectual Property Laws Amendment Act, which is now in its fourth year, is not yet implemented. But there are sections of the Patents Act and the Biodiversity Act which are already relevant to this topic. So from my position, I'm very concerned about there being a multiplicity of laws constraining uses of traditional works. If the bill were to be interpreted to constrain writing and publishing on South African indigenous knowledge, it will disincentivize books about South African indigenous knowledge being published in the country, thereby denying the South African public access to high quality published information about plants, which in turn may well have a knock-on effect on innovation and job creation in a wide range of applications, from agriculture, tourism, to biotechnology and public health, to name only a few. So the proposals for changes is the first one, the exception for academic purposes in clause 26.4e is too narrow. The exception should specifically include publishing and republishing of works that consist of or include indigenous knowledge resources. Section 28.2, importing criminal sanction for unauthorized uses, but similarly exempt uses allowed by the exceptions in clause 26.4.
And secondly, the bill should protect continued use and protection of intellectual property rights consisting of or containing indigenous knowledge resources that came into existence before enactment. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Professor Van Beek, for your submission and the critique on the bill. Other members, do you have questions to Professor Van Beek?
Thank you very much for the presentation, Professor Van Beek. Do you go to the Eastern Cape a lot?
I go to the Little Karoo lately, and also Eastern Karoo basically. Not so much Eastern Cape.
Because I see you are chairman of the Allied Council of South Africa, and that's, I was in the Eastern Cape recently. I took my mother there, and my daughter told me that is what is what the Eastern Cape should be based on, so it's the Allied. I thought maybe you'd go very often.
Yes, I go very often to the Allo industry. I think mainly based in the Albertina region, in the Southern Cape. But there's some initiatives in the Eastern Cape, in Uniondale, for example. I regularly visit Uniondale. But the Eastern Cape Allo activities have more or less come to an halt, sadly. Ikala Tappers is no longer, and that's very sad to see.
Professor, actually, what I want to know is, who funds your research?
The jointly is funded by the NRF and the DTR.
So you don't receive any funding from pharmaceutical companies at all?
I make a point not to receive any funding, because as a scientist, my integrity and integrity of the knowledge is absolutely important. And the moment you receive funding from any commercial entity, what you are publishing and saying is probably tainted, even if it's unconsciously tainted. So as a scientist, it is very, very important to be absolutely focused on the facts and not on propaganda or some marketing nonsense.
Chairperson, I would like to know from Prof. who are those three people, older people that have died already? Shall I say the people within from, since I am from that region, and from the sub-region, I would like to know who he's talking about, because I want to find out what is the situation. And then also you spoke of a book of info in the libraries, and I would like to know what is the name of the book. Thank you.
Yes, the people, let me say the professors of the field, the way I see. The one is the legendary Willem Barend Engelbrecht, that's long past, but his legacy was still present in some of the other people. Mainly, Gert Julk Terpse. As you know, in the Nakulan, people have small names, klein aantjes. So we make a point of putting in the klein aantje because that identifies the person, apart from the date of birth. I do not have the date of birth in front of me. I think you know who I'm talking about, if you're from the Kamiesberg. Gert Julk Terpse, Jacobus Kweki Corrius, Jan Dubbel Jan Joseph, and especially Anna Boom Stever, who I think could have been a professor at the university had the circumstances been different. A highly, highly inspiring, knowledgeable person who taught me a lot about the Kamiesberg tribes. The book is a thesis by Cronier, J.M. Cronier, and it is called Medicinal Plants of the Kamiesberg. It's quite a thick volume because this is now, it includes the original Afrikaans transcripts as well as the English translation. And it's lodged in the Springbok Public Library and in the Van Rensdorp Public Library. Then we have also donated a number of posters as part of what we call the feedback phase. So in the Kamiesburg you will find posters outlining the project and the main results, and also acknowledging the main participants. There were about, I think, 24 participants in total.
Okay, fine. Okay, actually. I can, like, acknowledge the names of those people. I do know who you're talking about. But the publish, you said it has been published in Springbok and Van Rensdorp. And I would like to know if it's one of the whole of Namakwa, or why not nationally? Why should it be only then in Van Rensdorp and Springbok? Because I think this is information that should go further.
Yes, thanks. Well, of course, it's a very thick book, this thesis. So we thought we will put one in the northern library and one in the southern library in the Namakwaland. The information is mainly about the Kamiesburg and the Namakwaland. But then, of course, the information is freely available if you look at the scientific publication. The scientific publication is that is the purpose of publishing such information, is that it's available to all. It's in the public domain. It can be sourced from Elsevier, from the journal.
Not nationally published. Not,
well, it's a thesis. So you can also, through the University of Johannesburg, obtain a copy of this.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just to the Professor, intellectual property is protected in terms of other laws. One is specifically, you know, presently under the auspices of the Department of Trade and Industry. Do you see any conflict, and do you have a preference for one of, you know, for this bill above the existing laws in terms of protection?
I think that the main problem that I see is that there are so many steps and hurdles and procedures that it's becoming very difficult. It's becoming a bit stifling. Me as an academic, I need to know how to comply with the laws, how to do the right thing. And even for me, it's very difficult to know exactly what is or is not allowed. I have not studied these laws in such great detail that I can point out areas of conflict. But I think that there is definitely areas of duplication where different laws are attempting to achieve the same thing. It's basically about transformation and restitution. And I think it will be a challenge for these different departments and different laws to harmonize and to fully dovetail so that duplication is avoided. I think the chairperson spoke about to have a one-stop shop. And I think that would be the ideal, where you have a single entity that deals with all of these matters and that's fully informed how to deal with these matters. Because I can tell you there are severe frustrations because of the lack of regulatory uncertainty that is there at the moment. So I'm confronted every day of my life with commercial entities that want to get involved, want to promote and do the promote part, but they are unable to do so because of regulatory uncertainty and a lack of feedback on their submissions and so on.
So you agree that there's a need to
concerted efforts.
The need to harmonize the different acts, yes.
They had not looked at the intellectual property within the Department of Trade and Industry.
No, I'm not deeply familiar with the details.
Okay. Then, any other input, another member? Other than 35.
Okay.
Prof, thank you very much for your submission, your presentation, and highlighting the areas that we'd want to see being critically looked at to enrich the bill itself. Thank you very much. We really appreciate that. And Shamaz here will circulate, make available to members your slides. Thank you very much. Members would now call upon Professor Kajika, who is the Chair of Intellectual Property Law and Stellenbosch University. Mr. Prof, do you want to come near?
Wow.
Indigenous knowledge. I can tell you what intellectual property is,
and I can tell you what intellectual property is not. Indigenous knowledge is not intellectual property, as currently understood. Intellectual property law, whether it's patent law or whether it's copyright law, there are of course trademarks and designs as well, but I think copyright law and patent law illustrate the purpose of intellectual property law quite well. It serves to generate new expression, new knowledge. That's the purpose of intellectual property protection. We want to incentivize people to create, to investigate, to come up with new knowledge. And for that, the law says, well, if you expend your energy in enriching society, we will give you a limited property right. We'll give it to you as a limited property right because at the end of the day, what you created will fall into the public domain and society as a whole will be enriched. That's really the purpose of intellectual property and that should be its sole purpose. So it has an inbuilt paradox. The paradox is that ultimately everything should be free to everybody. We want to enrich society. But the way human beings work, we have to incentivize people to create, and that's why we give a limited property right. What we sit with indigenous knowledge is, to some extent, the converse. We have, and as Professor van Wyk beautifully illustrated earlier, knowledge or know-how that has been in existence or been used for decades, probably centuries. So there's no reason or need to incentivize. What the law seeks to do now is actually take it out of the public domain potentially and prevent people from using it, which, you know, is to some extent, as far as I'm concerned, problematic. There is also this notion that our knowledge is being exploited by big corporates, particularly in Europe and probably the US. But I would hasten to suggest that I think it's largely anecdotal and not really supported by hard facts. The Hoodia example, as Professor van Wyk said, the previous speaker also spoke about, proved to be a damn squib, actually. The empirical evidence doesn't suggest that it was going to be the miracle drug for weight loss was claimed to be. But I think what Professor van Wyk touched upon is something that I think we might be missing a debate, missing in this whole debate. There's this idea that there's a big corporate coming in, seeing what traditional healers and so forth are using, and then trying to maybe patent the drug. Now, firstly, we have the Biodiversity Act, which says that if you use any indigenous plant resource as part of a patent application, you must make it known. So I think to that extent, you can't sort of surreptitiously come in and exploit our biodiversity. We have actually plugged that hole. But so what? So if somebody comes in and assuming that the Hoodia is the miracle weight loss drug that the Americans were hoping for to deal with their obesity, there's a very different thing in taking that plant, spending potentially millions trying to identify the active ingredient in the drug. That, I think everybody can concede that that's a scientific enterprise. You know the plant works, but you don't know why it works. And you expend time, effort, expertise to try and identify what the active ingredient is. And if you identify the active ingredient, and if you've gone further and you want to synthetically create that, you're good luck. That's what I would say. What we seem to miss in this whole debate is that it opens a potentially new market for the plant itself, potentially. And I think that's what Professor van Dijk was touching on, in the sense that there's a lot in our biodiversity that we can exploit as natural remedies, as the real thing. And I'm concerned, like him, that aren't we hobbling entrepreneurship in South Africa through red tape in this type of legislation? That's my concern. I think principally based, the DFC has gone down the right road, in the sense that indigenous knowledge or traditional knowledge is not intellectual property. It is something different. And I think there are things that we would really think should not be in the commercial sphere and shouldn't be exploited. So things of real religious significance shouldn't be found to be used in a way that's disrespectful to a particular community. And I think the legislation for that type of thing is required, but we should be concerned, as Professor van Dijk said, that we don't find ourselves in a situation where it's actually only South Africans who can't write about South African botany or folklore or cultural expression, because this law only applies in South Africa. So are we going to be sitting in a situation where an Australian can write freely about South African botany and plants and indigenous species and folklore, but a South African can't, because a South African is hamstrung by this legislation, has to jump through so many hoops, and says, well, actually, I can spend my time doing something else. So that's the real danger of getting this legislation wrong. Because we are blazing a lonely path on this enterprise. As I said, WIPO is struggling with this issue, trying to find international consensus. These things are very difficult to define. What's culture? What's traditional knowledge? And my concern is, aren't we taking too much potentially out of the public domain, setting up a whole bureaucracy that, like I said, hobbles entrepreneurship? So, for example, as I said in the portfolio committee, there are fantastically creative people in South Africa, youngsters that I see, that are using traditional designs in fashion, in architecture, in interior design, inspired from Xhosa art or Ndebele patterns. What are we saying about that type of activity going forward? Does that young entrepreneur now need to go through government bureaucracy to keep doing what they're doing? And isn't activity like that putting the best of South Africa on the world map, rather than, like I say, seeking a sort of path which is pretty lonely at the moment, because no one else is going to give this type of protection to what we consider to be our indigenous knowledge. So they can do with it as they please. It's only South Africans that are going to be bound by this and potentially limited by it. So that's my concern, that we must make sure that we don't hurt our own people through this legislation, that we don't create costs for them where the rest of the world don't face these costs and can use our knowledge, our know-how, without backing out it. But now our local scientists or our local entrepreneur is faced with the real prospect that the law now has placed restraint on them. I'm happy to answer questions. Like I said, I'm not an expert in indigenous knowledge per se. It's more intellectual property law. And if I were to have a hit list, I'd say right on the top is please, I mean, DST should be speaking to DTI. I don't know how you deal with it politically between departments, but that is something that needs to be addressed, because if that act comes into effect, I think it's going to do untold damage to our intellectual property law system. It brings in uncertainty, and an opinion has been expressed that it, in any event, is unworkable. So it's going to be a dead letter anyway, because it's just unworkable. So if I were to have a wish list, repeal Intellectual Property Law Amendment Act, right at the top. Second, do nothing. When I say do nothing is that even this proposed bill, as good as it is in principle, the fact that it provides for a purpose-built legislation, I'm concerned about the cost it may possibly impose on entrepreneurship and scholarship in South Africa, and the unintended consequences. So there are costs that may be or unintended, and that's why I say do nothing. If that is not acceptable, and politically you feel that you need to have legislation, then please make sure that this stand on its own, that the Intellectual Property Law Amendment Act is not referred to as at all, and as I said, preferably abolished. So that's my plea, if you want, or request, or submission.
Thank you very much, Professor. Your submission, and also linking to what the previous presenter has mentioned, and in also trying to bring everything together. I'll give an opportunity to members to ask questions.
Thank you, Professor. Can I just, as an intellectual property law expert, is there any other laws guiding intellectual property in South Africa other than IFLA? That's the first question. Secondly, why are you so against IFLA? Is it because they're trying to deal with TCEs, and that is bringing now the confusion in terms of this bill we are dealing with this? And just tell me a little bit more. If that is the case, then if we repeal IFLA in toto, will we not then harm intellectual property's guidance in this country?
Sure. So the intellectual property law in South Africa, we have, there's the Copyright Act, there's the Patents Act, there's the Trademarks Act, design, and then we have the common law of, say, passing off. So that's traditionally known as intellectual property. The IFLA Act seeks to amend the principal pieces of IP legislation, like the Copyright Act and the Trademarks Act and the Patents Act. So what it does is to force indigenous knowledge or traditional knowledge into an intellectual property paradigm. And as I said to you, the two are very different. Whereas intellectual property is intended to incentivize new creation, you're dealing with existing knowledge. Knowledge that has existed for decades or centuries, and now you're trying to take it out of the public domain and squeeze it into intellectual property. The two just don't fit. It's a square peg in a round hole, and it makes them a nonsense of intellectual property law. That's the thing. I mean, so for example, illustrate the say copyright, typically given for literary works, for artistic works, there has to be an author of that work, the work has to be original, so the author must have expended the intellectual effort in creating it. Now just there, you have a problem trying to fit in indigenous knowledge into copyright. Who's the author? How is the work original? It's been existing for centuries. And potentially, what's proposed is perpetual protection. So, right? Intellectual property gives you a limited period of protection because the rationale is that we want to expand the public domain. That work must become available freely to be used at some point in time. The rationale with indigenous knowledge is completely different. It's meant to be protected in perpetuity. So the two systems are at odds with each other, and what IPLA perversely tries to do is force indigenous knowledge into intellectual property paradigms and potentially make a mess of both systems, actually. Right? You're trying to use, if you want to, Western notions of copyright and authorship and all the rest to indigenous knowledge. And that's just, it's a muddle not worth going into. And like I say, produces, creates damage to our intellectual property system. And intellectual property, the nice thing I always say to students about teaching intellectual property is that it's a subject that has international harmonization. You know, our laws very much look like the laws in India or Brazil or UK or US because of international convention. And by trying now to put indigenous knowledge into IP creates a problem again, probably for our own people more than anybody else, because everybody else would not be bound by this weird type of protection, but our authors and our creators would be. And like I said, it simply doesn't fit. That's the bottom line. It simply doesn't fit.
Thank you very much. I think in my report you will raise the issue of the budget.
Any other questions? Let's thank you also, I think the submission of it enriches the previous presentation and to the committee. So we will indeed look at it, how it enriches the bill and take it forward. But also if we need probably your input at any other stage, and also please feel free to make submission if you wish to during the NCOP process when it's to specific provinces. And thank you very much. Very confident about the anti-community. What's going to grant it? We'll now call upon Mr. Nisugokuza, contractor. And just apologies to
we will sort it out when we're done here. Thank you.
Ngiyabonga ithuba. Ngicela ukubingelela indlu.
Siyakubingelela.
Sikhalo. I must submit an approval first for this country. I think it's the issue of traveling from the provinces. As we are citizens from far in Devon, it's a little bit difficult to reach the site in terms of the flights. There are very few flights that are traveling from that site. But all in all, I do appreciate the opportunity to meet with your committee at Interpersonal. And also to make a few emphasis on the issue of the ITS bill as submitted before us. And I also take note that we met after our first presentation last year here. We met in Pretoria, and some members of the ITS working committee as established by the DEC. Who are stakeholders in the ITS Bill Committee in putting a little bit of emphasis on specific areas within the bill that we are debating today. But mainly, I'm here one in support that we have a better. Before me has submitted, we have a better legislation. It may not be 100% perfect, but it's a working legislation compared to what is available now. Why I'm raising that, I'm not going to go through the actual because I have a presentation prepared to be on top there. Why I'm raising that, I'm going to put a little bit emphasis on what policy the ITS policy was proposing that we need to look at when we engage with the issues of indigenous knowledge system. If you remember, the ITS policy identifies four key principles, and among those principles, it provided that we need to look at how we harmonize the issue of indigenous knowledge system with other systems, and also versus the opportunities that are there in global trade. It also identifies shortfalls in terms of, let me say, the issues to be addressed in terms of the previous administrations or the apartheid administration, which suppressed and oppressed the indigenous voice. And also, that suppression is also extended into economic opportunities. And also, the policy also identified shortfalls when it comes to how you educate a person within the South African cultural, economic, and also other opportunities in terms of human resource development. What we have observed, and let me start by identifying my school within the IKS space. I come from the Congress of Traditional Leaders, and we have been looking for such kind of bills within the government to accommodate the former oppressed indigenous voice. So how do we emancipate this kind of a voice? And it's a little bit difficult. So a space was then created in the late 90s for the IKS policies to be created. We participated, and we have been from then even up to today. I was then assigned with a group of other indigenous leaders in the country in Contralesa to make sure that we keep on looking and sustain. So as a former deputy president, this was my scope within the organization to look, but I've been also my own mandate has been extended further. Say I must keep on participating and reporting back to our executive that is administering the organization. So presenting that background, we then got an opportunity to engage with the DST and other departments, because remember, there were 4 departments that were identified to engage with ITS, which is Arts and Culture, DST, Environmental, and I'm just forgetting the 4th one. So a committee was then created in line with what the policy was providing in terms of progress and transformation. Within the policy, there was a scope of an advisory committee which was supposed to be created within the DST of identified knowledge holders, and that advisory committee would then, when the Act, which is this bill, is also acknowledging that scope, that we need to have a kind of an advisory committee and also create a NICSO office. When you create a NICSO office with the identified mandate, that advisory committee will need to expand the search. That advisory committee will also need to assist the minister in terms of developing further the policy and the any future amendments on the Act. We have been participating on that space, and I'm saying when we met in Pretoria at the DST office, other stakeholders were representing other elements got an opportunity to make their presentation. But all in total, as the participants within that particular space, we are on behalf of those stakeholders, I can then clearly state that we have a better legislation. And our focus currently is on the section that's in the bill that deals with the norms and standards, and also the accreditation. Because if you remember, the policy was calling for a development of a system that will need to be aligned in terms of education, that will need to be aligned with the SACWA. Frameworks in terms of qualification and authority. Let me say, all of us, all these years, SACWA has been present. And this process, I'm proud, Chairperson, to inform the House that as we were engaging with SACWA Direct, we have assisted SACWA in the development of their new policies from the first policy in terms of the accreditation into currently they've got 3 policies that are active. One deals with the recognition of prior learning, and we have, as these units, we have assisted in the development of, in terms of acknowledging the space which are, in terms of our indigenous knowledge practitioners are contributing. And also, SACWA has also recently adopted the policy on occupational qualification, which proposes another way of qualification, where they call it a path qualification. Let me make an example of a mechanic. If you want to become a mechanic in a traditional qualification approach, was that you go for 3 years and do everything about the car. Then you get qualified from the tire to the engine to the windscreen and to all operations about the car. Currently, SACWA is in the process of developing this type of qualification. They also, the indigenous practitioners have managed to make some contributions there. So you don't need, in the space of THP practitioners, like the traditional health practitioners, you've got those who need to go full qualification up to a level where they become experts and specialists in certain areas of knowledge. But you've got opportunities also wherein a person will need to go and do a 6-month qualification, the part qualification in this case, on the how the battery, and then you become a battery specialist. Then you get employed by the battery center instead of you becoming a full. For you to be employed by the venture center in a traditional approach, that you have to go and do 3 years. So in exploring those opportunities and matching with the norms and standards in our consultations as stakeholders in different stakeholders in areas that we identify, because we went through a process of setting up pilot projects in areas where traditional knowledge is practiced. Not that we selected Amman to create a sample, not that the whole country is not practicing, but we found that there are areas where in a certain specialization is dominant in that particular province. And then in the other province, a certain specialization is dominant in the other province. So, let me make an example. In terms of the THT Act, it identifies in traditional health practitioners, it identifies certain skills like diviners and those who are engaged with, which we call them sangoma, and those who are engaged with traditional circumcision, and then you have also those who are healers in terms of providing umnyaka. So in conducting such kind of research, we were able to identify that within IKS, in terms of norms and standards, it's possible to develop norms and standards that are, if you are, for example, you are going through a process of being initiated into a sangoma according to Nguni traditions versus the Ntuana traditions or the Sufi traditions. What is that you can set up as a standard to benchmark that which you, when that advisor panel is established? The advisor panel can then say, upon interrogating that particular person towards the proof of the qualification, let me say proof of the qualification, I'm using that word. This is not the proof of the qualification, but they say towards the proof, take that case of towards the proof of the qualification. These traditions could then in terms of their culture and traditional training programs or initiation programs. Both, they've got elements that could then submit, as you say, in terms of the basics from you enter up till you qualify and who receives you when you enter, who assists you with your training, who sits as a peer group to say we can do a peer review mechanism. Exchange. Say, this person, in terms of our traditional cultural systems, is competent to go out and practice. I do believe that a person, with the submission, if you take submission of other practitioners who were up in Pretoria, this confirms that that area in the act, which says there's a need of some kind of, there's a need of NISO providing that technical support. And when the technical support is created, a framework for the, and I'm trying to look for the right word, where a panel of experts will be created for those within a specific tradition to assist in implementing and monitoring the norms and standards in line with what SAQA is currently developing. Because, as I said, the policies that SAQA is developing, we are getting an opportunity through this particular space to make such kind of contribution. In terms of the IP, I believe you have asked experts who have made a submission to the committee. I can say in terms of the IP, intellectual property rights, this act provides a generic approach, which provides for a framework for exploitation of copyright, but in a controlled way. Because if you talk about how do we define copyright within the IKS versus the other, and how do you trade within that particular space? I think it's a new terrain, but we have in the world other systems that we can benchmark with to look at how do you, if there is a product that, in terms of in the country that is communally owned, how do we set up a system for beneficiary sharing, and how do we set up a system also for accepting ownership of that kind of a product. And I know that in India, their approach was to take all ideas related knowledge into a public domain space. And we are benchmarking as we are working to say, in other countries, how are they dealing with this particular aspect? Maybe, Chairperson, I can stop there and if there's, you know, maybe those who are doing it more clarity on some aspects, I can let me put one. But I promise to send you to make a submission of what I was speaking. Thank you.
Okay, yes, thank you very much for the presentation. Indeed, I appreciate the submission that you have done very much. Other members, any questions, please, then you can take a question. Okay. There are no questions, so probably because they did ask some questions when you were at the committee before last year. As I said, we would really appreciate to have your submission so that as we finalize and consolidate the public hearings, we should have it on record.
Thank you, Secretary. Maybe to make one note, we had a session in Musina with Fana, with practitioners of the, I think they had it. We touch with those who deal with the traditional settings. And they were very proud to say they have got a clean record in Bombay. And then when we were asking them in terms of boys who are coming in and those who are also graduating out of their bush school. And then we were saying, what is the secret? And they said, the knowledge has been passed. We have not yet been disturbed. Knowledge has been passed on from one family to another family in terms of specialization. But we are saying now, how do we deal with the situation where it is now the knowledge was disturbed over the years? Because in our, when we do this kind of research work, we have picked up that in communities where there was some kind of forceful movement, or any other external influences, could be the church or other external influences, you will find that the rates of death when that comes to try to recover this kind of rituals, it's so high. They said, no, we have a situation wherein we have assisted communities that were forcefully removed by organizing them a training program. We have been trained and assisted, but we are not training somebody who comes from outside of identified families. So one leader was saying it took him 3 years, 3.5 years, to assist with that particular person to recover the skills that were lost within the building. So, as the committee on our side, we're looking at an opportunity. Say this is an opportunity for the whole country where in communities are still practicing, and specifically for the communities that are also challenged by the experience that I've referred to as forcible movers or any other external influence that has attacked and then degraded the role of this particular community in that particular community. And also to take into account, Chair, that IKS is not only about the traditional health practice. It also includes other things. Other things are not commercially, are not available, are not ready for commercial exploitation, but there are also other opportunities that are available for commercial exploitation, which tends to address the challenge a little bit in the matter of how do you train in this particular space. Legislation are not there that regulates that trend. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, I've noted you on a person. I think the transfer of skills is very important from family to family, or generation to generation. But how do they monitor the fly-by-night initiation schools and and those who purport to be teachers, who purport to be traditional the surgeons, and that ends up in posh circumcisions.
In Limpopo, the provincial administration, in terms of the provincial government and the provincial house of traditional leaders, they have established a committee which works with it's a multi-task department committee which works with traditional leadership in terms of making sure that the process of establishing a camp, I don't know if it's a city school, a camp for such kind of rituals, social rituals to be performed. It's in terms of the administration, compliance to health and all other related, this committee is able to assist there. But when it goes to a Northwest, not the whole province that is doing it in Northwest, but you've got communities that migrated to Northwest over the years who are still practicing. But with the assistance of the same departments also, those communities are still able to do it. So I think we have, if you look at Northwest and Western Cape, currently they're doing it also in Western Cape, and the results are very promising in terms of that sharing of how are they able to do it successfully in terms of avoiding debt. And remember that also Western Cape is a community of all South African people who migrated down to Western Cape. So when they practice, what is also becoming very interesting in their migration coming down to Western Cape is that they are able to benchmark and also check their traditions among all these communities. So it's not that it's rigid to say the Western Cape format is pure 100% this format, but they agree, they consult each other, among each other, and agree to say how are these boys going to go to the mountain, and those who are running the program, in terms of their experience there, it seems that something very good is happening within these three provinces. And also take into account what KwaZulu-Natal. In KwaZulu-Natal, we have communities that are practicing. And because they are a minority, maybe it works very well. But the majority of KwaZulu-Natal are not doing this, the actual pattern. And then when we're engaging with the traditional leadership of KwaZulu-Natal, also those the structures that are linked with the supporting the growth of Induna, who are supporting the growth of the growing up of the boy child, the girl child. They were saying, no, the government must not only focus on the ritual of catching. The process of Ukulisa Bumdwa involves more than just the medical procedure. So they then challenged the EDSC task team to say, please expand beyond the THPS, because we are involved in KwaZulu-Natal, what they call the Ibuso system. They said, we want to recover the Ibuso system. And also in Northwest, that's what they said, we've got the Pato in Northwest. Pato is bigger. Ibuto is bigger than just physical. If I process and the states are going to accommodate this emancipation of the African boys, include the whole system, then within the system, when we recover the system, Ibuto system or Pato, we will be able now to say when a boy and a girl child reach puberty, what is supposed to be.
Thank you. And so in transferring skills and knowledge, I think you need to have the system so that you use what is called a high number of skills. So So why they would not be the same, but probably there can be some sharing of information. But before you respond, can I think of another person?
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you, Mr. Kuzwai. To what extent the Conferencia go and engage the communities and real grassroots communities like this one? That's the first question. And then, Mr. Kuzwai, you correctly said that indigenous knowledge isn't just African traditional medicine, there are other aspects of it as well, and one of it is are these intangible spiritual influences of African traditional medicine, and to what extent will those do you envisage benchmarking those influences, those spiritual influences of African traditional medicine? Thank you, Chief.
Thank you, Chair, and honourable member. There will be a mediator practitioner, so I am able to contact the voice and sort of plus with the song. The question first is to what extent Conferencia is able to consolidation in the grassroots level. Chairperson, the Congress of Traditional Leadership is a an organization which is governed by its constitution. I will suggest that members must also check me online to get the background of the organization, because of course the website which has these relevant documents. It's a network, let me say, an organization which was created mainly to extend local consultation, take the voice, and create a lobby capacity. So it was formed in many districts and I think of missions. So it created that capacity to consult, lobby up, and also able to bring back and then report back and also expand in terms of consultation. It's constituency, which is a national constituency. I think we've given a technical contribution, including university and the structure of the membership. Yeah. Where the provincial government will then to say, you are just a cultural organization, and are a cultural organization. We cannot recognize you as the other provinces are recognized, because the university, people of the UK are not in the traditional authorities. So what extent are we able to? In the case of Western Cape, our capacity was to lobby for the creation of what today is called lethal the OSM consolidation structure. I'm just forgetting how it is called, but before the structural board is created now with legislation at a quota level to say the Minister of must consult this particular community to address the issue. Last question. two formations on top. I was saying on top, in terms of the Islam. And through Alain, these two, the government that only two are available. In other, as I was highlighting, that you go to Al-Nasar, you will have this Arab claiming to be national in Al-Nasar because of the previous history. The process of consultation with the traditional healers and traditional health practitioners is still ongoing. But there are two who have managed to align at the national level. It does not mean that other associations that are practicing from, who are not aligned must not be given the space. They must be given the space. And I'm not here to speak on behalf of traditional healers and traditional health practitioners. I am here to say, you met them in Victoria, they made their own submission, but at a level of being, of lobbying, EDS has provided some kind of policy advisor structure which assists in terms of facilitating discussions with the dialogue from a number of traditional health practitioners. Let me make an example. There is within the traditional health practitioners, there is a traditional health council which is created by through the Traditional Health Act from Department of Health. The Traditional Health Council nominated practitioners to participate on this committee that I'm referring to. And while others, the association also nominated their own traditional health IPS holders to participate. And the space is open because the process of consultation will never stop. And these associations are created by people who are able to recruit others, share the same objectives, and the constitution is agreed upon, then you align. If you are not aligned to that kind of arrangement, I think we are a free country to set up your own organization and then get also seek for an opportunity to raise your voice when there's an opportunity to raise your voice. That's my take, that even in traditional health practitioners, they are more than one. That's why they align themselves into two measures at the national level. But they are more than one association. For example, if you go to Bembe in the Bombe, I think we met about eight associations from one district. But when it comes to certain, when you consult them, they reach a stage where they say, no, in principle we agree here. But as associations, we are going to have also our opportunity to submit our nominees to come and support and deal with internal preparation. So I think the space is very open. But it's only that I was raising the issue to say, in terms of this, I will recommend to the committee to say, please extend your either maybe to a workshop, either there is no pillar that this bill must be. A workshop must be planned for this bill to be interrogated by practitioners beyond traditional health or who, because it's what those who never got an opportunity to participate. But in terms of traditional leadership, you will have Contralesa, then you will have the House. Because the House is a state circle, the House of Christianity is a state circle. But when it comes to traditional health practitioners, you will have the Council and all other associations getting to be invited to make their own contribution. But it becomes now much more easier and better to engage the workshop.
We send out an advert for this public hearing. So any information or individual who saw the advert or knew about the advert can was free to contact the secretary to the committee and come and make submission. And I don't think that that we expect that controversy is homogeneous, every traditional leader belongs to controversy. So it's just like political parties, you've got a choice of where you want to belong, where you think that your ideas and your values are better explained and encapsulated in the constitution of the association of the organization. So any other formation can come and make their own submission. But I would like to ask the professor to make a comment at this point.
Thank you very much. I think that the question asked by Honorable Orson needs to be addressed around the organizations that which are the traditional class organizations. There are definitely more than 200, but the affiliate to major organizations. So I think probably it's the language in which Mr. Tuko is putting it across. The organizations are umbrella organizations, and there are many more associations under them, TOSA and others. And so to that extent, the participation is much broader than the named organizations. And others also participate in their individual capacities in terms of the processes. So it's not just the formal processes. So I thought maybe just a clarity around that, but it might reduce the consultative process that has been going on throughout the years on these issues if our audience is prescribed. So I just wanted to make a clarity on that issue. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And thank you, Mr. Kusai, for your submission and your response to the questions from members of the committee. So Mr. Kusai was the last to make a presentation. At the least that is here for today. The public hearings will still continue tomorrow and on Thursday. So there are some who were supposed to come today who would ask to come back tomorrow or Thursday. But Shannon will welcome that and send it to another member so that you know exactly who is coming. But in tomorrow's program, we might finish around about the same time as today. But I would like to thank members of the committee, the presenters, the department, all our visitors who came. I think even if you're going to present tomorrow or Thursday, it is important to see through so that you can hear what others are submitting, probably to enrich yours or to agree with them or not. Thank you very much for coming. We'll continue tomorrow morning, starting at 10 once again, and again on Thursday, and others will be the following week. The process of the submissions of the public hearings. I just want to say to members of the committee that the Dr. Renee Osborne Mullin had a baby boy yesterday morning at 10:29, Zachary Aiden Mullins, weighing 3 kg. Both the baby and mom are well. So we extend our congratulations to her and the bounty. Dr. Renee Goldstone-Lewis, she's our content advisor. She's on maternity leave and she delivered yesterday the infection. Thank you very much. This then brings us to the end of the public hearing. hearing on day one.